The term high seas has new meaning when a drunken captain orders the crew to put up too much sail. Heavy gales are blowing, and a disaster is brewing in today's story, cutting out work for all hands. Welcome aboard the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast, folks. Let's get situated here. Stow your gear. Getting ready to shove off. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. I've got a short story for you and a couple of book reviews and recommendations. So right up front, I want to make a recommendation to you for a book that I think you should read. It's called Into the Raging Sea, and it's by a lady named Rachel Slade. And it has a subtitle, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Now, this was published in 2018, and you'll recall that the ship El Faro was a container cargo ship that was going from Florida to Puerto Rico back in 2015. And it went right into Hurricane Joaquin, and it was sunk with 33 sailors aboard. And it was quite a shocking event at the time, if you'll recall. I know that, it sent a tremor through the shipping and the naval and the Coast Guard communities, because it's kind of unusual for a ship to just go right into a hurricane and sink like that. What with all of the technology, the weather tracking technology, the GPS and the sat phones, somebody could have called up that captain and said, hey, get the hell out of the way of the storm, turn around. But lo and behold, 2015, El Faro sinks. Now, this lady, Rachel Slade, she is a great writer. She has been living in Boston, so, you know, she's salty right there to begin with. And she has worked for Boston Magazine and several other major reputable publications. And she is like an investigative journalist, so she's got her chops for writing. But the cool thing is that she does her homework. She goes to the shipyard in Pennsylvania where El Faro was originally designed, and she talks to some of these old guys that were there, like welding the keel and working as engineers in the shipyard. And, you know, she digs into the original drawings of the ship and goes and researches the modifications that were made to the ship over the years and comes up with these potential reasons why the ship may have been taken on water unknown to the crew at the time. She also gets a hold of the recordings that were being made on the bridge. I mean, second by second, hour by hour, day by day, this entire voyage, everything happening on the bridge is being recorded right up to the second that the ship sinks. So, I mean, she's got these recordings and you can kind of see what's happening, really see what's happening. You're like a fly on the wall on the bridge as this whole thing is unfolding. Then the other thing she did was she got recordings and she went to the National Transportation Safety Board trials and the investigations and the public hearings that they had. She interviewed a whole bunch of Coast Guard people. And then she goes and she talks to the husbands and wives and girlfriends and some of the adult children of the sailors that were lost on the ship. And she puts this thing together and it is just amazing. I mean, she's got a chapter where you're on the ship and you're heading south. And then she goes into the backstory. And then another chapter where on the ship heading south. And then more backstory. And then another chapter where you're on the ship going south. So the whole thing is like the situation's getting worse and worse. And you know what's going to happen. I mean, there's no, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you know the ending of the story. But what you're really finding out is why and how it's happening. And it's just this kind of tragedy, right? A couple of really nice things about the book, though, is it's got some drawings in the front of the book of the ship itself. So you get a layout. It's got an org chart of the chain of command on the ship. So you get that. It's got a map of the ship's voyage and the path of the hurricane. So, you know, if you like reading a good sea story and you like kind of checking back to the map or checking back to the org chart or checking back to the drawings of the ship, it's all there. It's really, really well done. And this book was just awesome. I highly recommend it. So, Into the Raging Sea by Rachel Slade. Great, great story. Okay, I have another quick book recommendation for you. This is a science fiction book, but it has kind of a sea story tie-in. It's called Beacon 23. And it's really crazy because it's this guy, he's way out in outer space and it's centuries from now. And he is manning a beacon that's in space. And it's kind of like at a place where these spaceships come out of warp drive after they've been like flying at the speed of light or whatever through space. They come out of this portal and they, you know, enter this junction area. And he's in this beacon right there in this lighthouse. And he's a veteran. So he's got this kind of PTSD going on. And he's also like an old salt himself. A mercenary sailor from you know, many space travels. And so he's out there by himself in this beacon. And there are ships coming out of this portal. And there's wrecks, you know, there's spaceship wrecks. And there's all this flotsam of wrecked ships floating around there. And then he gets involved with some bad characters, some pirates that, you know, try to hijack some ships and take over his beacon. And you know, I'm not going to ruin the story for you, but it's a great, great story. It's I'll read you just the blurb on the back cover. It says, "For centuries, men and women have manned lighthouses to ensure the safe passage of ships. It is a lonely job and a thankless one for the most part, until something goes wrong, until a ship is in distress. In the 23rd century, this job has moved into outer space. A network of beacons allows ships to travel across the Milky Way at many times the speed of light. These beacons are built to be robust. They never break down, they never fail. At least they aren't supposed to. With Beacon 23, best-selling author Yu Howie delivers white-knuckle suspense with aliens, war, and madness, all combining in a story of one man living aboard a beacon and his battle against the solitary blackness of space." So just a really cool story. I love these stories that combine the sea story with science fiction elements. And they're out there, but you have to try to find them. And if you're a nut for this stuff like I am, this book is a gem. Just one last mention to Yu Howie. This guy was just a guy. He started writing, you know, he worked in a bookstore and he would write on his breaks and on his lunch. And he wrote a whole series. One book is called Wool. Another is called Shift. And then the other one is called Dust. And there are it's a trilogy. And they were just runaway bestsellers for several years there in the around 2010-ish, around then. And he just gained great renown and really made his claim as a writer. And he's gone on to write a number of books that have a real nautical kind of bent to them. So I saw this one, Beacon 23, and I got right on it, and I totally didn't regret it. The other nice thing about this book is it's only about 200 and something pages, so it's a quick read. So Beacon 23 by Yu Howie. All right, so before we get into the story for today, let's get a word from our sponsor. Today we have another story from Ocean Adventures, published in the 1850s by John Sherborne Sleeper. We've been working our way through this book, and we have several more stories to go. Today's story is called Cutting Out Work for All Hands. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The good ship Will-O-the-Wisp, bound for Boston to Amsterdam, was rushing rapidly through the water toward her destined port. The wind was a couple of points abaft the beam from about north-northwest, and it blew a strong breeze. The royals, flying jib and mizzen and foretop gallant sails were furled, the weather clew of the mainsail was hauled up, and as the stanch ship dashed through the water, deeply laden as she was, her timbers and bulkheads croaked and sung like mutinous frogs in a pond, the water under her bows roared like the Norway maelstrom, and she left a wake behind her as broad, as foamy, and as crooked as that of a huge Dutch galliot. A fair weather sea would, now and then, when she broached a little to her course, gently come over the weather bulwarks and electrify those at the watch who happened to be in the way. And while the helmsman labored at the wheel, exerting all his strength and all his skill, the chief mate, Mr. Halloway, kept one eye on the sails and spars aloft, and the other to windward, watching the appearance of the clouds, while the watch on deck were speculating on the probability of having soon to take a double reef in the topsails. At this interesting moment, Captain Cornelius Grampus made his appearance on deck. Captain Grampus was a man who, although he commanded a temperance ship, was never a member of the Temperance Society. He adopted the principle that temperance was a good thing for those who could not keep sober, and he carefully obeyed the orders of his worthy owners, in excluding all kinds of liquors from his forecastle, and had even often been heard in port haranguing his crew on the folly of impropriety of getting drunk. But as he always knew when he had enough, and as he said, he never got drunk himself, he considered it unnecessary to pledge himself to temperance, or even to abstain from the free use of intoxicating drinks, either at sea or on shore. Captain Cornelius Grampus came on the deck of the Will-o'-the-Wisp. He was a plethoric-looking man, of rather short stature, with a face as round and as full as a Thanksgiving pumpkin, and with a complexion as ruddy as the gills of the noisy monarch of the barnyard. Indeed, with his huge eyes apparently starting from his head, his peculiar and ungainly figure was sprawling flippers, and his inflamed visage, he forcibly reminded one of a lobster after he had been immersed in a pot of boiling water. Captain Cornelius came on deck. He looked aloft, and his eyes seemed lighted up with anger. He cast a savage glance at his mate, as if he wished to annihilate him on the spot. He walked several times fore and aft the quarter-deck, then stopped abruptly directly opposite Mr. Halloway, and, after grinding his teeth together, addressed him fiercely as follows. "Mr. Halloway, how fast does the ship go now?" 8 knots and a half, sir," replied Halloway, with a conciliatory tone, for he knew the captain's custom of an afternoon, and feared that the storm was about to burst forth. 8 knots and a half? Only 8 knots and a half? What is the meaning of this, sir? This ship ought to go at least 10 knots with this breeze. You must be mistaken, sir, or it is high time to make more sail. Heave the log, Mr. Halloway. The log was hove, and the result was given by the mate as follows. She takes 9 knots off the reel, sir. The wind seems to increase. Poh! 'Tis only a good wholesale breeze, and when the wind is fair, we must improve it. She must go 10 knots. We must crack on more sail and try her speed for once. Set the fore and mizzen topgallant sails, Mr. Halloway. It blows very hard and flaws, sir, exclaimed the mate with a deprecatory look. Well, let it blow, thundered out Captain Grampus. I want it to blow. Call all hands and get more sail on the ship. Do you think I don't know what I'm about? I'll show you how to carry sail, my good fellow. Remonstrance, of course, was useless. All hands were called and were on deck in a trice, for the watch below had ever since 8 bells been in the momentary expectation of being roused up to reduce sail, and as the wind had increased, they were somewhat astonished that they were wanted for the purpose entirely different. However, it is Jack's duty to obey orders without questioning their propriety. If the ship should be capsized or dismasted or swamped through the folly or obstinacy or foolhardiness of any of our officers, the fault is not his, and he washes his hands of all responsibility. Up there, men, and loose the fore and mizzen topgallant sails, shouted Mr. Halloway. The topgallant sails were loose, and after much shivering and slatting, they were sheeted home. Captain Grampus paced the quarterdeck, looking and doubtless feeling as proud and important as a turkey cock in all his glory. The ship steered badly, and whenever the heaver flaw struck her, and she came to of her own course, the masts would bend and yards would buckle, and a loud cracking and snapping almost the rigging seemed to admonish the skipper to be prudent, that the Will-o'-the-Wisp was not to be trifled with. At such times old Grampus would open his lower deck ports, pour out tremendous broadsides of oaths and abuse upon Blue Water Jack, the helmsman, and upon Mr. Cat Harping, the second mate, who was standing by the wheel, cunning and occasionally assisting Blue Water Jack in heaving up the wheel. "Now throw the log, Mr. Halloway," exclaimed Captain Grampus, with a grim smile of satisfaction, as a heavy flaw struck the ship, careened her some half a dozen streaks, and made all crack again. "Aye, aye, sir," replied the mate, in a tone which indicated disgust rather than satisfaction. "Hold the reel." The log was accordingly thrown, and Mr. Holloway reported that the ship was walking off at the unprecedented rate of 9 knots and a half an hour. 9 knots and a half, shouted Captain Grampus. "Only 9 knots and a half? She must go faster than that. We must set the foretopmast studding sails." Mr. Holloway stared, but he knew that as Captain Grampus was in full sailing trim with a good cargo of cognac and Madeira on board, it would be useless to try to convince him of his folly, and the men were ordered aloft to rig out the foretopmast studding sail boom. It required great care in setting this sail to prevent it being split in pieces, but Mr. Holloway was a good seaman and a sober man into the bargain, and after a pretty tough siege, he succeeded in setting the sail. The wind kept gradually increasing, and the old ship seemed to leap madly along, straining like a well-trained racehorse to reach the goal and looking for almost every point on the compass but the right one. The boom, too, buckled like a whipstick, and the crew expected every moment to see it broken short off and the sail rent into ribbons. Captain Grampus noticed the bending of the boom. "Mr. Holloway," said he, "that foretopmast studding sail boom, like a freshwater dandy, cocks up its nose rather too much. Clap on the lower studding sail to keep all straight and let the good old ship go ahead." "Get along the lower studding sail there, men. Clear away the boom and reeve the gear," exclaimed the mate. "Aye, aye, sir," replied Ebenezer Oakham, a hearty old salt, at the same time saying in an undertone to Harvey Scuttlebutt, "I say, Harvey, the old man has got his beer aboard and is cutting out work for all hands." The lower studding sail was brought on the forecastle. The halyards were bent on and the gear all prepared. Captain Grampus had just been below, freshening the nip. He was much excited and paced the deck rapidly, sometimes swearing terribly to the helmsman for not steering small, sometimes bawling to the mate for not bearing a hand in setting the studding sail, and sometimes chuckling and grinning like an overgrown baboon. At length, the lower studding sail was ready for hoisting. The men clapped on the halyards and outhauler. The wind struck the sail, which fastened by the four corners, belied out and caught more than a capful of wind. At the same time, a flaw struck the ship, and she came to of her course some 2 or 3 points. The sea dashed against her weathered bulwarks, rolled into the waist, nearly filled her decks, and made the will-o'-the-wisp shiver and shake as if she had been suddenly attacked with fever and ague. "Hard up the helm, you scoundrel! Hard up, I tell you! You know nothing, soldier," screamed Captain Grampus. "Hard it up, sir," exclaimed the helmsman, puffing and blowing like a porpoise and almost overcome with fatigue, for his office had not been a sinecure. At this moment, the wind piped harder than ever. The weather forebrace of old core rope could no longer stand the racket. It parted. The studding sail boom broke short off by the iron. The foreyard flew fore and aft, and the topsail yard followed its example. The pressure upon the topmast was now greater than it could conveniently bear, and away over the side went the foretopmast. As a matter of course or courtesy, the main topgallant mast followed suit, the headsail being thus suddenly reduced, and the whole spanker being set, the ship luffed up, and such a fluttering of canvas was seen and heard as has seldom been witnessed on board a craft where temperance watched over the cabin. Captain Grampus seemed to be really astonished at this very natural result, but his astonishment gradually gave way to indignation. He gave the mate a stare in which perplexity and fury seemed combined, a stare that was evidently intended to annihilate, exclaiming at the same time in a voice of thunder, "There, Mr. Holloway, I think you have done it now." "Done it," replied the mate in a bitter tone, gazing despairedly upon the wreck. "Yes, you have done it with a vengeance. Come, lads," he continued in a more cheerful voice, "there's no help for it now. Let us go to work with a will and clear the wreck." "That's right, Mr. Holloway," said Captain Grampus. "'Tis a pity you made such a fuss merely about setting a lower studding sail. But as you say, there is no help for it. Clear away the wreck as quickly as possible. Save all the spars, sails, and rigging if you can, and get up a new topmast, and make sail again as soon as possible. Thus saying, Captain Grampus staggered down to the cabin, and after seeking for consolation in a glass of raw cognac, he leisurely turned in. As his head disappeared through the companionway, Mr. Holloway muttered some reply which was by no means respectful of its character or complimentary to its superior officer. "There," said Eben Oakham to Harvey Scuttlebutt, "what did I tell you? Didn't I say the old man would cut out work for all hands?" Well, that was a wee bit of a short sea story, but a good one nonetheless. That is how it goes, you know. Ships want to go fast, captains want to go fast, but sometimes they push it a little too hard. Nice little short story there, though. I'd like to do a quick shout out for a novel that I wrote myself. It's called Sailors Take Warning. I want to just read a review that was posted on Amazon. Truly original sea story, horror story aboard a massive aircraft carrier. Fresh and original use of horror, sci-fi, sea mythology, and a love story. Great unique setting aboard a U.S. Navy ship set in the near future. Torres takes a bold approach and does not blink or flinch as his characters go through the most extreme situations you're likely to read about. It's a fast 200 plus pages. I like what one of the other reviewers said. This is not your grandpa's sea story. 5 stars for sure. So folks, if you like a good sea story and you want something that's set in the near future with some horror, crime, and a bit of romance, you'll find the crew of 5,000 men and women trapped at sea aboard the USS Nimitz. The ship is doing some experimental testing, and the story just gets increasingly outrageous as you move through it. It's called Sailors Take Warning, and it's by me, Malcolm Torres, and it's available on Amazon in ebook and paperback format. I'd greatly appreciate it if you would grab a copy and post an honest review. Thank you. So hey, folks, that brings us to the end of another episode. Again, be sure to look me up online, connect with me on Instagram and Twitter, Facebook. Tell a friend about this podcast. I'd appreciate it. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.